Hello, hi, and welcome to Off the Hour Friday. I am your host, Carla, and we are going to start the show listening to Joy Crook's When You Were Mine.
In the summer of 16, was it love or nicotine that made us mellow on the 31st?
Was When You Were Mine by Joy Crook. You're listening to the Friday edition of Off the Hour. It is currently 5:03 and I'm your host, Carla, here to bring you your daily source of corporate free daily news. We have quite a bit to get into today. The first headline, and something that's been sort of a topic for the past few weeks, has been housing. Basically, what happened this week is that the Czech government plans on introducing Bill 31, And once adopted, the bill, which is tabled by the minister responsible for housing, France-Hélène Duranceau, would allow landlords to refuse a request to transfer a lease for reasons other than the serious reason, which they didn't really define what was a serious reason. But a lease transfer is one of the only rent control measures available to tenants. It's when you transfer your lease to another person before the end of the 12-month period provided for protecting the next tenant from a significant rent increase. An important detail to this story is the fact that the Minister Duranceau, she is a former real estate agent. So when you take into consideration the fact that she is a former real estate agent, a lot of the things that she is saying and doing make a lot of sense. The bill has been staunchly criticized for adding fuel to the fire of an already hostile market for not only leasing but also buying. For context, the average rent in Montreal for a one-bedroom apartment is $1,599, which is a 10% increase from last year. And again, as we say many times, wages are not increasing 10% each year. So the bill has been staunchly criticized, right? And in an interview with Nouveau, she was trying to defend the bill, and she said, "You cannot use a right that is not yours to assign a lease to someone else on terms that you decide when it's not your building. The tenants who wants to do this, they must invest in real estate." I don't know if you know this, but the median cost of a house in Montreal is $601,500, which is a lot of money. Most people in my generation, I am Gen Z, we will not be able to afford a house. The only reason I would technically be able to afford a house is if my parents retire, go back to Haiti, and leave the house that they already bought to me. Which is really sad because most people don't have that. And then again, it's a lot of hypotheticals. Most people cannot afford a house. The housing market is really expensive, and it's out of many people's reach. She tried to give an apology on Wednesday by saying, "I said that, and I'm sorry if it sounded insensitive. I was in a legal and economic description of things. On the contrary, I'm very sensitive to what is happening in terms of housing right now." I feel like if she was sensitive to things happening in housing right now, she would not really want to table this bill. There are other things in it, but the ending of leasing transfer is the main thing that people are mad about. And the thing is, once she said that and that the attention of the media was on her, an investigation by Pivot, which is a news outlet, revealed that according to the Quebec Lobbyist Registry, because lobbyists here have to register, a business partner and friend of the minister responsible for housing has an active mandate to lobby the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing. And they found out that they were business partners because they both owned, not necessarily a business, but they both, they owned two businesses together, and now they're like shell companies, so you don't really do much. But it's known that, like, they are friendly. This is incredibly sad for people who are looking for housing. These past few weeks, there have been a lot of stories on this show about either rent evictions, tenants having to hold out for their apartments, people getting evicted, the high cost of rent. Starting next month, there's actually going to be a show called Radio Rent Eviction, which tackles the housing issue in Montreal. And I think just by virtue of the minister being a former real estate agent, I don't think she sees it as a problem because real estate agents, they make money off commission. So the more you're able to sell houses, the more money you make. So there's no real incentive for you to be sensible to the housing crisis. There's this great think piece in Le Devoir titled Marie-Antoinette nous explique l'immobilier, which translates to Marie-Antoinette explains to us housing. It's written by Alexis Lamy-Téberge, who is a law student at UDM. And while normally I would caution against calling a woman a Marie Antoinette because it's quite a sexist term, I think the metaphor here is kind of appropriate. It's a great read. It's 7 minutes. I think you should highly read it. There's a lot of ministers that you don't really know of them until they like have a huge mess up. And I feel like this is her first huge mess up. But by virtue of the CAC having a supermajority, this bill is probably going to pass. And I don't feel like there's much that you can do except for reaching out to your local representative. But then again, they have a supermajority. So if they want this bill to pass, it will pass, unfortunately. I'm going to move on to our next news story. So in case you do not know, I mentioned it last week. This week is Formula One weekend. And I personally love the sport of Formula One. I've never been to a Formula One event because it's quite expensive. I think the cheapest ticket this year were $500 for a weekend. And it is a great source of revenue for the city because you make money from the event itself, from tourism, from people booking hotels. But also here, Formula One and the Grand Prix does have some downsides. I think the one you think of, which is the most obvious, is sex and human trafficking. Formula One weekend is the weekend where the peak of the peak of sex trafficking and human trafficking happens in Montreal is during the Grand Prix weekend. Another story that is recent is that an accommodation service which is reserved for patients of Cree origin in a hotel in downtown Montreal is congested due in particular to forest fires that are raging in northern Quebec, but also rooms at this establishment are still offered as a high price to tourists this weekend. So due to Formula One weekend, this service that is given to Cree people is basically being overwhelmed. So the Cree Board of Health and Services of the James Bay has an agreement with the Espresso Hotel, which is located on Guy Street, to house patients who need to receive health care in Montreal, because again, the James Bay is quite remote. So sometimes you need to go to Montreal to receive health care or to get a particular surgery. They have an agreement that to house patients who need to receive healthcare in Montreal. It's confirmed by several sources, right? The hotel allocates rooms to the council for patients coming in from the north, as well as spaces where medical personnel provide for care on the second floor. Dozens of patients of First Nation origin had to give up their hotel room during the day on Wednesday. They've been relocated to other hotels, such as Hôtel Dieu, a former hospital converted into a shelter for homeless people, even though these Cree patients are in no way homeless. On this busy weekend, rooms are offered at $670 for the night on Friday and Saturday at the Espresso Hotel website. So the speculation is that they are basically kicking out Indigenous people so that they can upsell rooms during the Grand Prix weekend, because again, it's one of the busiest weeks in Montreal. It's like a highlight of the summer. Some Cree people who were due to return home in the past few days, but it has been impossible due to wildfires that are raging in northern Quebec, says Lyle Cox, who's a representative. And an additional number of smoke vulnerable Crees were evacuated to Montreal this week due to wildfires. So this is a really sad story. With all the stories that come out about Formula One weekend, I'm like, do we really need to have this event? It's quite sad. I feel like there should be better accommodations than having to resort to an agreement with a hotel, which is a for-profit company. But then again, there's not that much that can be done about it, right? Wow, time is moving fast. So we're moving on to our third story before we go on to a short musical and ad break. So coroner wraps up public inquiry with 63 recommendations to prevent suicides in Quebec. So today, the coroner's office unveiled a list of 63 recommendations to prevent suicide, all calling for Quebec to raise its standard of care and understanding of suicide and substance abuse. One of those recommendations is to better include families into the caregiving process when their loved ones are at risk. In the report, Coroner Julie Kim Godin points out that the public inquiry has reinforced the need for upstream action. Great importance must be attached to early detection of mental health disorders and disorders related to substance abuse issues to prevent problems from escalating, says the report. The report also stressed that all people are likely to become at risk of suicides and they need to be taken seriously. There have been a lot of stories in the past few months of people suffering from either mental health problems or substance abuse issues not being taken seriously as being a suicide risk. The recommendations are addressed to the government ministries, police force, healthcare institutions, community organizations, professional orders, and Quebec's police academy. The common theme is more resources, more follow-ups, more services. In her 63 recommendation, Godin recommends the Ruchier Treatment Center, which discharged Michael Ryan, one of the five cases analyzed by the coroner, to improve the way it identifies people at risk of committing suicide and homicide. In another recommendation, Godin calls on the Ministry of Public Security, Health, and Justice to create an advisory committee to review the legal framework surrounding the sharing of confidential and privileged information. The coroner targets regional health boards in several regions, recommending follow-ups with people people once they are discharged from hospitals and ask police departments to conduct thorough event reports of the following intervention. In the report, Gunite also asked that the ministry set up more mental health and addiction clinics, deploy interdisciplinary frontline teams across the province to improve care and conduct follow-ups, and to make psychiatric and addiction professional services more available. I hate to be this person, to be like, the only issue is the money, but I feel like for the government, the only issue is where are you going to find the money to fund all these programs. The report also asked the ministry to implement a province-wide strategy for suicide prevention, as well as a mechanism to audit suicides and catch possible shortcomings in services. I feel like all the recommendations in this report should be adopted, but then again, I feel like there's always going to be people who make the obvious question of where is the money coming from. But with an issue like suicide, I feel like you should be able to cough up the money, because it's not only like a health hazard, it's also a societal hazard. If you have a lot of people who, you know, are at risk of suicide and you're not really doing anything to help them, as a system, you have failed them. So we're going to move on to a musical break. This is CNQDL by Clay and Friends featuring Louis-Jean Cormier.
Orange, dread, la camomille. All you need is love, faut carré me dise. I'll see him when I'm sur mon grand bateau. J'garde mes yeux ouverts quand il pleut de l'or. Dans tout bon jeune berceau, je fuis dans le sud pour ne pas perdre le nord. Ce n'est que de l'eau. Ça pleut tellement ces temps-ci. C'est pas pour rien qu'on s'enfuit. C'est un temps pour tomber des pavés plein la mort. Des amis qui s'effacent comme ça sans crier gare. Des larmes de gin, des larmes de joie. Des petits miracles, des petits miracles. Mais toi, tu changerais l'eau en quoi? Ce n'est que de l'eau. Cette tranche de vie sont minuscules comparées à mes pupilles. Ce n'est que de l'eau. Ce n'est que de l'eau, camarade. Ce n'est que de l'eau. Ce n'est que de l'eau, camarade. Ce n'est que de l'eau.
Ce n'est que de l'eau. Fatage is proud to present the number one indigenous DJ team in the world. Hallucination. Live in concert, Wednesday, June 21st, for National Indigenous Day. This party will be rocking from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Daylight, lightning, and the thunder. Sun, moon, stars, and the hunger.
Hosted by the incredible Uncle Bubba. Comedian with special guest, Kong and Zazzy Boys. Inside the parking lot of the Green Room, 443 Rue St. Michel, Gunasatage, Quebec. Incredible music provided by DJ Crowd. Delicious food provided by Moz Place. Taking to the next level by RickyDEvents.com. Curated by Kathleen Gabriel and Timmy Deer Jr. Sponsored by Green Palace Casino. The Green Room. Hallucination. Don't miss it.
And we're back. You are listening to Off the Hour Friday. I'm your host, Carla. It is 5:20, and we're gonna get back into the news. This is rather a sad day for news now that I think about it. All the stories that I've chosen are quite sad. So something about being there's something where people refuse to admit that we are in a recession, even though the price of everything is going up, right? But for me, the first signs of a recession, other than the fact that recession pop starts to emerge, which, if you don't know what recession pop is, like, if you see all the music that was big in like 2008, 2009, your Lady Gaga's, your Black Eyed Peas, really like bombastic. I'm having fun. I don't care. I'm in the club. I'm going to dance. Recession pop, that's what it's called. It's usually a sign of like you're entering a recession, is when pop music starts to get more like poppy, not a care in the world, is when there starts to be cuts in media. That usually is a sign that you're entering a recession. So BCE is laying off 1,300 people, is closing 40 news bureau and 9 radio stations across Canada. I think it's quite sad to see people lose their jobs, especially when it's due to, they usually say it's budget cuts, but like sometimes the CEOs of these companies are making like millions of dollars, and it's like, okay, could you not like sacrifice your yearly bonus just to, you know, save your employees? But 6% of the media division workforce is being let go. The eliminate position, which again, about 6%. Bell says that the job cuts are in response to unfavorable public policy and regulatory conditions that it can no longer wait out. The plan entails moving to a single newsroom approach across brands, allowing for greater collaboration and efficiency, said Richard Gray, who is the vice president of news at Bell Media. Bell Executive Vice President Robert Malcolmson said that the company's media branch can't afford to continue operating with its various branches, such as CTV National News, BNN, CP24, and its local TV stations and radio channels operating independently of one another. So the stations that are set to close are Winnipeg's Funny 1290, Calgary's Funny 1060, Edmonton's TSN 1260 Radio, Vancouver's BNN Bloomberg Radio 410, Vancouver's Funny 1040, and London's News Talk 1290. Bell Media is also selling Hamilton's AM Radio 1150 and AM 820, as well as Windsor's AM 580 to an undisclosed third party, which is subject to CRTC approval, as is anything in the media. But in response to this news, Magda Konietza, who is an associate professor of journalism at Concordia, said that the days of companies making money off of providing the news are gone. To that, she said, quote, "The media was supported by a very rich advertising market, and they were providing civic news because of the prestige that came with it. Today, Google and Facebook have basically eaten that ad market. There's no advertising dollars left for journalism." She also said that if there is an agreement that journalism continues to be essential to a democracy, then new ways outside of corporate model need to be developed to produce it. In the U.S., there has been a growth in philanthropic funded journalism. Think NPR, think Substack, where people just pay directly for news and journalism. But folks in communities starting new news organizations that are more suited to the needs of communities that are supported by foundations concerned about local democracy. In Canada, where there are fewer rich foundations to provide that kind of support, she said that the government intervention has helped through tax credits to existing news organizations to help them hire journalists, and through money to hire news reporters into existing news organizations through local journalism initiative. I will be, as someone who really wants to work in media, I feed this and I'm really saddened. No one deserves to lose their job, no matter how much you don't like what they're doing at their work. Like, no one deserves to lose their job, especially in the current job market, housing market, economy that we're in. So this next story, which is, again, quite sad. I am a fan of sports. But particularly tennis, Formula One, and hockey. I'm a big hockey fan. This is a story that I saw pop up. Not that many people were talking about it, but I felt like it was important. I talked about it with my mother, who is a nurse, because I have talked to her about this multiple times, and I have since recently learned that, like, CTE is the reason why my mom never really allowed me to do, like, a lot of any type of physical sports that I would want to do. My mom did not allow me to play hockey because she did not like the idea of me receiving hits to dad, even though in women's hockey you don't do the hits. But still, my mom was not a big fan of the idea of me, you know, playing any like big contact sports. So study finds Canadians legend Henri Richard had stage 3 CTE at time of death. So Richard died at 84 in 2020 after a long battle with Alzheimer's disease. And posthumously, he was diagnosed with stage 3 chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is CTE. So CTE is a progressive brain disease associated with repeated traumatic brain injuries, according concussions, and including concussions and repeated blows to the head. Most of the time when you hear about CTE, it is in relation to the NFL, where many players after dying have been diagnosed with CTE. There's a player who was on the Pittsburgh Steelers whose name is escaping me right now, but he was like the first case that they diagnosed with CTE. And a bunch of players, they sued the league, they came to settlement, and then the NFL had to recognize that the game of football can cause you to have CTE, right? It was a whole big thing in like the late 2000s when Roger Goodell became commissioner of the league. So in contrast, Richard Saint-Denis released the finding of his father's brain study, hoping to bring attention to the risk of repeated head injuries in hockey. To that, he said, quote, "I hope my father's brain donation and diagnosis will lead to more prevention efforts, research, and eventually a CTE treatment, because there is no treatment for CTE. And also, the only way for you to be diagnosed with CTE is unfortunately for you to pass away, because they need to dissect your brain to be able to, I watched a movie about this, but basically they need to like create like layers of your brain so that they're able, to see the reduction in, gray matter in your brain." Richard, who was known as the Pocket Rocket, was Maurice Richard's younger brother, won 11 Stanley Cup with the Canadiens from 55 to 75. Again, he died in 2020 after a long battle with Alzheimer's disease. And the foundation says that 16 of 17 NHL players whose brains have been donated have been diagnosed with CTE, including Hall of Famer Stan Mikita. And the important distinction here is that usually when you talk about CTE, it's about people who are known as enforcers, as in people who would get into fights. But the distinction here is that Henri Richard was not an enforcer, and CTE still ravaged his brain. It is far past time for all of us in the Canadian sports community to acknowledge the long-term effects of repetitive impacts on the brain, said Tim Fletchner, who's the executive director of CLFC. The NHL, which has made helmets mandatory in 1979, has consistently denied a link between hockey and CTE. I think that this is an interesting story to keep following, especially for me, who's someone who likes sports. And it often brings to me like the really interesting dilemma of how can I be watching like people kind maybe not like ruining their lives, but doing so much damage to their bodies, you know, like last week was the Stanley Cup. And usually when a series in hockey is over, they release the injury report. And it's always something like, oh, so-and-so was playing with a broken leg. This person had a broken sternum. This person had three cracked ribs, but they kept on playing. And at some point, I'm like, you know, you're not like messing up your body just for the sport, but like once you retire, you're still going to have to live with those injuries. And like, how is there no one stopping you from continuing to you further harming yourself? Because say you break your leg and you have to, I don't know, get it amputated or whatever, like your career's over. So was it really worth it? That's a question I have a lot. I don't think it's that easy to find an answer to it, but it's something to follow. A few weeks ago, I talked about how there was a dispute between employees at the Notre-Dame-des-Neiges Cemetery and the management. So the Montreal Cemetery workers and managers have reached a tentative agreement signaling a possible end to the strike. So the strike has kept the cemetery closed for more than 6 months, and apparently it's going to come to a close on Thursday. After a marathon of negotiating sessions overnight Wednesday, the parties, the cemetery workers and management, agreed to accept the recommendations of a government-appointed mediator, according to the Labor Minister Jean Boulet. The development was the first sign in months of the strike, which has shuttered the cemetery and frustrated families who have been unable to bury relatives or visit their loved ones' graves since January could be nearing the end. During the shutdown, the cemetery has become overgrown and unkempt. Its grounds are littered with branches that fell during April during the ice storm. It briefly opened on Mother's Day, but lineups formed outside the cemetery's main entrance. It will remain closed during Father's Day, and more than 300 bodies have piled up in storage during the strike awaiting burial. Hopefully, all the workers, they got a fair deal. I'm always hoping for people to get a fair deal in these instances. I think they did, since, you know, it lasted 6 months, and I don't think that they were just going to agree to anything. I'm happy that the workers, got their agreement, and I'm happy that the families are finally going to get some closure in the form of, burials and being able to visit their loved ones that have passed away. We're going to move to a short break. This is High and Choking, Jack Green Remix. Thank you. And we're back. You are listening to Off the Hour Friday. I'm your host, Carla. One of the main difficulties I have when making this show is that I tend to put like the heavier, longer stories at the bottom of my docket, because basically every week I have to like, you know, choose what news stories I talk about. And for some reason, I always put like the easy stuff at the beginning and the hard stuff or the long stuff at the end. And it's like, it should be the opposite, because if you run out of time, that has yet to happen so far. That, and also having to like moderate the amount of stories that I do, because oh my God, on Wednesday, I just have like 55 stories and I have to like, you know, bring it down to maybe 10. And it's better when I have a guest, because it's like, okay, I can do a five and we can talk a lot. But when I'm doing it myself, I have to pace myself, because according to my mom who listens to this show, I talk quite fast. So I have to pace myself so that I don't, you know, breeze through everything. But we'll see. We're at story number, what, 7 of 10? 7 of 10. Oh, wow. Okay, I'm good. Okay, so this next news story, illegal drivers in the line of sight of the SAAQ this weekend. I'm going to admit my thoughts on the SAAQ are not that positive after they absolutely messed up the registration system. As someone who doesn't have her license yet, it took forever for me to try to book an appointment. And having to do the lines there are awful. They should have never rehauled the website. But anyways, so dozens of traffic controllers will crisscross the streets of the metropolis from Friday to Sunday in order to crack down on drivers not authorized to drive for pay in the middle of the weekend of the Grand Prix in Montreal. And as I said, I should have put this together with the Grand Prix story, but I didn't, because I have a weird methodology. So in March, La Presse did an investigation where they revealed that there are illegal taxis. There's like an illegal taxi sector in Montreal, which are people who drive for pay, but they don't have, you know, the really expensive taxi licenses that you need to use to have to drive a taxi. And, you know, Uber and Eva and other services like that, they're legal, right? But these people are not doing any of that. They're just like operating, I don't know, either on Facebook, on social media. They're not like registered to drive, and that can be quite dangerous, because if something happens to you and you're, you know, in a drive for pay unregistered car, there's like no way of you to like flag the person, because at least Uber, you can contact Uber, you can contact the police, they have the license number, they have the driver number. Same thing with a taxi, but you don't really have that if you're, you know, on an illegal taxi. So I would advise just staying clear of those. But Quebec has tightened the screw. At the beginning of June, the Minister of Transport, Geneviève Guilbeault, announced the establishment of fines up to $50,000, which will now impose on unauthorized drivers. And again, because it's Grand Prix weekend, they know that there's going to be a lot of people, so they're trying to, you know, make their quick buck. You know, the city also said to try to take, you know, public transportation, which is the best way to, you know, get around the city, especially, you know, if you're going to the Grand Prix, just take public transportation. It's really easy. All you need to do is get on the yellow line and get off at Île Notre-Dame. It's not called Île Notre-Dame. I forgot what the name of the station is. I haven't been there in a while. But, you know, you get off at the Île Notre-Dame spot. You walk around. It's super easy. It's really convenient. And you don't need to pay a really expensive taxi that might not even be legal to take you there. So highly recommend taking public transportation if you're going to the Grand Prix. Next story. So, Publisac. So, Publisac will have a restricted distribution in Greater Montreal by the end of 2024. This has been a story for so long, the idea of trying to restrict, not the usage of Publisac, but trying to restrict the distribution of it. And they keep talking about it, but like no actions is concretely made to restrict the passing of Publisac, because I still get them every like week to 2 weeks. So, the 82 municipalities of Greater Montreal have given themselves until the end of 2024 to adopt a system of voluntary membership and printed advertisements such as the Publisac, following the example of the metropolis. The elected officials of the Montreal Metropolitan Community, CMM, officially adopted Thursday morning the third version of the Metropolitan Residual Materials Management, which has been the subject of consultation for several months. It provides for 40 measures that will come into effect from 2024 to 2030 in order to reduce the quantity of waste and recyclable materials. By December 31st, 2024, all cities in Greater Montreal must also have adopted a bylaw prohibiting the distribution of shopping bags of any thickness. However, more than 50 municipalities concerned have already followed suit. So as you can see, when you go to the store, now they give you a paper bag instead of giving you, you know, like a plastic bag, or you have to bring your own reusable bag. So I love this story because I do not like Publisac. My mom loves them because she uses it to shop for coupons and deals, but I feel like most people my age, we don't really use Publisac. And if you want coupons, you can use online apps. They have those, or you can just like request a Publisac. I don't see why everyone is subjected to have a Publisac, even though we don't use them. I find them also quite wasteful because it's a lot of paper. If you're distributing to every, you know, apartment, house, block, building, it's a lot of people. It's a lot of waste of paper. It's a lot of waste of trees. I'm all for banning the Publisac 2024. So, second to last story, tourism visas deadline that hurt Montreal. So, in Montreal, we have the Palais des Congrès, and there's a lot of international congresses and conferences that are due to happen in the summer. The problem is that a lot of these conferences attendees have, the expected amount of attendees has been reduced because they cannot obtain a visa. I, for context, I'm born in Haiti, and I immigrated to Canada when I was 2. And from what my parents tell me, they also had this problem of a really, really long delay for visas. For context, my dad got his visa in, I believe, 1997, and we left to go to Canada in 2004. So by the time that my dad applied for the visa, to him getting the visa, he had gotten married, had a kid, had his house robbed. A coup would happen. So there's really long delays for trying to get a visa. And Quebec is trying to apply pressure to Ottawa so that travelers can be able to obtain a visa, because a lot of the countries that are targeted by long wait times are mostly what we would call third world countries or the global south. The examples that they give, in Senegal, it takes about 332 days to issue a visa to people who apply for it. In Djibouti, it's 558 days. Nigeria, 732 days. But the worst record for slowness is Antigua and Barbuda in the West Indies, which is 914 days. That's almost 3 years to be issued a visa if you're coming from Antigua and you want to go to Canada. 3 years to wait for a visa. That is unacceptable. That is absolutely unacceptable, having to wait 3 years for a visa. So Ottawa's slowness in granting visitor visa endangered the holding of certain international events in the metropolis. As I said, there's so many long delays. And Mylène Gagnon, who's the VP of Tourism Montreal, said that we've been working on the group for 3 years. People know they have to apply for visas. And out of the 8,000 participants, I barely got 4,000 who were able to come. I'm not saying that the other 4,000 did not have visas, but out of the 4,000, 50-60% of cases, it's because of a visa. It's huge. All the same, the impact can have international conferences. There was another quote where she said that she's trying to work with Ottawa, and they keep changing the standards for people to be granted a visa, but they never tell them what the standards are. So there's a lack of transparency in why you are denied a visa or why it's taking you so long to be able to be granted your visa. I absolutely hate this as an immigrant. I remember before I became a Canadian citizen, traveling to and from this province was an absolute nightmare because I would have to be questioned at the airport when I was like 10 and they're asking you, you know, do you have drugs? And it's like, I'm 10. Like, I'm not. But hopefully, every story I say, hopefully the situation is going to change, but it's not going to change. There's a lot of cynicism in these stories nowadays, but yeah, it's probably not going to change. It's going to take a lot, especially post-COVID. It's something that they mentioned that, you know, in 2019, it was already kind of a slow process. But since COVID, it has been significantly slower trying to get a visa, especially when you consider the fact that for 150 countries, people cannot enter Canada without a visa, right? So if I say go to the United States, I don't need a visa. I can just show up to the border with my passport, say I'm here to visit X person, and I'm fine. But for most countries, again, mostly third world countries or countries from the global south or developing nations, the citizens don't have that privilege. You have to, you know, plan far in advance. And if it's going to take you 3 years for you to get your visa, why would you come to a medical conference in Montreal, you know? So that story frustrated me. Our final and last story of the day. So the Quebec Superior Court is authorizing the exhumation of the remains of DNA testing of two babies who are Innu, who died in the same hospital of Bicamo, because the family had been instructed not to open the coffin after learning that their children had died. But now they don't know if their child was actually buried, because again, they were instructed not to open a coffin. So they don't know if the coffin is empty, if say something happened to their kids, or are they actually dead? Like, you know, they said this happened back in 1970, but it took about 50 years to get the process going. These exhumations are the first authorized under a 2021 Quebec law aimed at helping Indigenous families learn more about the deaths and disappearances of their children in Quebec. Health and Quebec Health and Social Services Facility, the identity of the boys are protected by a publication ban. I'm happy that these families are finally getting, you know, some justice, because it has to be absolutely awful to learn that your child potentially did not die like they told you, and that there might be out there living. The treatment of Indigenous people in this country has been absolutely abhorrent. So hearing a story like this, although it should shock you after you learn everything from, you know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it's not that shocking. You really hope, there's a detail here of the two, you know, babies. One was 4 months old when he died. He was admitted to hospital with whooping cough on May 14, 1970 and died 13 days later. Her body was claimed by an undertaker who told the family not to open the coffin until after the burial. Which, how would you open a coffin after burial? But according to exhumation request, the coroner's report of the boy's death is incomplete and medical records are non-existent. So, yeah, hopefully these people, they get justice because they absolutely deserve it. All the stories I did today were quite, I don't want to say dark, but they're, I don't know, a lot of the news that is reported tends to be a bit doom and gloom, because there's this practice of not reporting happy news, but, you know, happy news are harder to come by than, you know, sad news, because it's easier. I don't know. One thing that you learned, though, is that, like, tragedies sell more than happy stories, unfortunately. That's just the way it is. So, final song is Matt Olubowski, The Year I Was Undone.
I'll take my time even though this isn't how you do it when you're thinking on a dime. I worry about my life. Can I?
Was The Year I Was Undone by Matt Olubowski. There are 7 minutes left of the show. You're listening to the Friday edition of Off the Hour. I'm your host, Carla. So, usually we end this show with a recommendation of something you should read, something you should watch. I've been doing them alone these past few weeks since my co-hosts are on vacation. And so, this week's recommendation is a bit of a weird one. I've been in a very like documentary mode. So technically I have like two, but it's more so like one. You'll see. It's like three technically. Okay. So I have been in a documentary watching mood where I just like watch a lot of documentaries on random subjects such as Ruby Ridge. For some reason, a lot of, I watched one by like firefighters on 9/11. A lot of like weird, maybe not weird, but like, you know, one was about like a shirtwaist factory fire that happened. But I think the one that for me fascinated me the most is one called The Poison Squad. And which led me to pick up a book called The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century by Deborah Blum. But the documentary is called The Poison Squad. It's made by PBS. It's available on YouTube. It's a part of their American Experience Films series. The documentary talks about Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley, who was a doctor during the Gilded Age of the United States. One thing to know about the Gilded Age is that there was no regulation when it came to food. Food manufacturing could put basically whatever into their food. There was no like labeling law. You weren't like required to label what's inside of it. You could call something milk, but it wasn't actually milk. An example that they would give is that they would put like, I think one part milk to two parts water. And they would like call it milk. And they would like put like calf's brain, like grinded up calf's brain to like simulate cream. You know, milk used to be preserved in formaldehyde, which, fun fact, formaldehyde is what they use to embalm bodies nowadays. Peas were kept green with salicylic acid, which today salicylic acid is like a chemical that is mostly used in face cream. Rotten meat was injected with borax so that it could like stay apart and like not, it a lot of stuff like that, which makes me really happy to be living in an age where there's actually food regulations. But Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley, who was part of this thing called the Pure Food Movement, which is, you know, trying to get manufacturers to basically produce what they say it is. So if you're producing milk, it's milk. It's, you know, it's not, you know, formaldehyde. It's not like, you know, watered down milk. If you're, you know, if you're making meat, the meat has to be fresh and like not be preserved with all these chemicals, things that you don't really think about and you take for granted. I remember at the end of the documentary, someone said, you know, Dr. Wiley's legacy is the fact that I can walk into a grocery store and not wonder that, you know, if I eat peas, I might die. It's a great documentary. It's a great series. The story of Harvey Washington Wiley. He's a great person. He's like the father of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. I think it's just wild sometimes to just see how people are living, to see how much progress you've made. So I highly recommend you watch The Poison Squad. It's available on YouTube. Highly recommend. Great watch. So next week is going to be an episode of STEMinism. I highly recommend you tune in. They're great. Their show is great. As for this show, there's going to be a few switch ups. Radio Vendor Eviction, which is a show that tackles the housing crisis, is going to premiere next month. I highly recommend you tune in. We're going to close the show with Wind Up Space by 1010 Benja SL. I have been Carla. I hope you all have an amazing weekend. And I will see you probably next week. So have a good one, y'all.
Tuned. Bonsoir tout le monde, vous êtes sur les ondes de CKUT à votre émission d'art et de culture du vendredi, l'émission Café. C'est Alex qui vous parle en direct du studio de CKUT avec Lynn. Allô Lynn!
Allô!
Ça faisait longtemps, je m'étais ennuyée.
Oui, moi aussi!